This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC43176, The Third Twin, by Ken Follett. Copyright 1996 by Ken Follett. Read by Madeline Bazard. This book contains 422 pages on 11 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. A young woman scientist happens upon a genetic research project to produce the ideal soldier. She locates and becomes involved with one of the cloned men, who stands accused of a rape committed by his twin. Her research uncovers a vast conspiracy to genetically alter all of society. Strong language, violence, and descriptions of sex. Bestseller, 1996. From the book jacket. In this scorching contemporary thriller, Ken Follett has crafted an electrifying tale of the chilling possibilities of genetic manipulation. Jeannie Ferrami, a brilliant young research scientist studying the genetic components of aggression, makes a startling discovery. Using a restricted FBI database, she locates 2 young men who appear to be identical twins. Steve, a law student, and Dennis, a convicted murderer. Yet they were born on different days to different mothers in hospitals hundreds of miles apart. When she delves into their backgrounds, forces as powerful as the Pentagon and the New York Times take notice. The more she learns, the worse it gets. Steve is accused of a terrible crime, which he swears he did not commit. As Jeannie finds herself falling in love with him, she has to ask herself how she can be sure he is different from his murderous twin brother. When her life is threatened, she realizes there is much more than just a scientific problem facing her. Unwittingly, she has stumbled upon evidence of a conspiracy involving a top biotech company, right-wing politicians, and her own university. Their aim is as shocking as it is technologically possible in this era of genetic manipulation. The reshaping of American society according to their own reactionary, racist, and sexist principles. Set at the leading edge of new technology, this is the scary but compelling story of a brave woman who pits her wits against some of the most powerful people in the world. Gripping, timely, and fascinating from page 1, The Third Twin shows Ken Follett at the height of his storytelling powers. About the author, Ken Follett is the author of 10 international bestsellers, including A Place Called Freedom, Crown 1995, A Dangerous Fortune, and On Wings of Eagles. He lives in London, England. Other books by Ken Follett: Night Over Water, The Pillars of Earth, Lie Down with Lions, The Man from St. Petersburg, The Key to Rebecca, Triple, Eye of the Needle. To my stepchildren, Jan Turner, Kim Turner, and Adam Brower, with love. Sunday, 1. A heat wave lay over Baltimore like a shroud. The leafy suburbs were cooled by 100,000 lawn sprinklers, but the affluent inhabitants stayed inside with the air conditioning on full blast. On North Avenue, listless hookers hugged the shade and sweated under their hairpieces, and the kids on the street corners dealt dope out of the pockets of baggy shorts. It was late September, but fall seemed a long way off. A rusty white Datsun, the broken lens of one headlight fixed in place with an X of electrician's tape, cruised through a white working-class neighborhood north of downtown. The car had no air conditioning, and the driver had rolled down all the windows. He was a handsome man of 22, wearing cut-off jeans, a clean white T-shirt, and a red baseball cap with the word security in white letters on the front. The plastic upholstery beneath his thighs was slippery with his perspiration, but he did not let it bother him. He was in a cheerful mood. The car radio was tuned to 92Q. 20 hits in a row! On the passenger seat was an open binder. He glanced at it occasionally, memorizing a typed page of technical terms for a test tomorrow. Learning was easy for him, and he would know the material after a few minutes of study. At a stoplight, a blonde woman in a convertible Porsche pulled alongside him. He grinned at her and said, "Nice car." She looked away without speaking, but he thought he saw the hint of a smile at the corners of her mouth. Behind her big sunglasses, she was probably twice his age. Most women in Porsches were. "Race you to the next stoplight," he said. She laughed at that, a flirtatious musical laugh. Then she put the stick shift into first with a narrow, elegant hand and tore away from the light like a rocket. He shrugged. He was only practicing. He drove by the wooded campus of Jones Falls University, an Ivy League college much swankier than the one he attended. As he passed the imposing gateway, a group of 8 or 10 women jogged by in running clothes. Tight shorts, Nikes, sweaty T-shirts, and halter tops. They were a field hockey team in training, he guessed, and the fit-looking one in front was their captain, getting them in shape for the season. They turned into the campus, and suddenly he was overwhelmed, swamped by a fantasy so powerful and thrilling that he could hardly see to drive. He imagined them in the locker room, the plump one soaping herself in the shower, the redhead toweling her long copper-colored hair, the black girl stepping into a pair of white lace panties, the dykey team captain walking around naked, showing off her muscles. When something happened to terrify them, suddenly they were all in a panic, wide-eyed with dread, screaming and crying, on the edge of hysteria. They ran this way and that, crashing into one another. The fat girl fell over and lay there weeping helplessly, while the others trod on her, unheeding, as they tried desperately to hide or find the door or run away from whatever was scaring them. He pulled over to the side of the road and put the car in neutral. He was breathing hard, and he could feel his heartbeat hammering. This was the best one he had ever had. But a little piece of the fantasy was missing. What were they frightened of? He hunted about in his fertile imagination for the answer, and gasped with desire when it came to him. A fire. The place was ablaze, and they were terrified by the flames. They coughed and choked on the smoke as they milled about, half naked and frenzied. "My God," he whispered, staring straight ahead, seeing the scene like a movie projected onto the inside of the Datsun's windshield. After a while, he calmed down. His desire was still strong, but the fantasy was no longer enough. It was like the thought of a beer when he had a raging thirst. He lifted the hem of his T-shirt and wiped the sweat from his face. He knew he should try to forget the fantasy and drive on, but it was too wonderful. It would be terribly dangerous. He would go to jail for years if he were caught. But danger had never stopped him from doing anything in his life. He struggled to resist temptation, though only for a second. "I want it," he murmured, and he turned the car around and drove through the grand gateway into the campus. He had been here before. The university spread across 100 acres of lawns and gardens and woodland. Its buildings were made mostly of a uniform red brick, with a few modern concrete and glass structures, all connected by a tangle of narrow road lined with parking meters. The hockey team had disappeared, but he found the gymnasium easily. It was a low building next to a running track, and there was a big statue of a discus thrower outside. He parked at a meter, but did not put a coin in. He never put money in parking meters. The muscular captain of the hockey team was standing on the steps of the gym, talking to a guy in a ripped sweatshirt. He ran up the steps, smiling at the captain as he passed her, and pushed through the door into the building. The lobby was busy with young men and women in shorts and headbands coming and going, rackets in their hands, and sports bags slung over their shoulders. No doubt most of the college teams trained on Sundays. There was a security guard behind a desk in the middle of the lobby, checking people's student cards. But at that moment, a big group of runners came in together and walked past the guard, some waving their cards and others forgetting. And the guard just shrugged his shoulders and went on reading the dead zone. The stranger turned and looked at a display of silver cups in a glass case, trophies won by Jones Falls athletes. A moment later, a soccer team came in, 10 men and a chunky woman in studded boots, and he moved quickly to fall in with them. He crossed the lobby as part of their group and followed them down a broad staircase to the basement. They were talking about their game, laughing at a lucky goal, and indignant about an outrageous foul, and they did not notice him. His gait was casual, but his eyes were watchful. At the foot of the stairs was a small lobby with a Coke machine and a payphone under an acoustic hood. The men's locker room was off the lobby. The woman from the soccer team went down a long corridor, heading presumably for the women's locker room, which had probably been added as an afterthought by an architect who imagined there would never be many girls at Jones Falls, back in the days when co-educational was a sexy word. The stranger picked up the payphone and pretended to search for a quarter. The men filed into their locker room. He watched the woman open a door and disappear. That must be the women's locker room. They were all in there, he thought excitedly, undressing and showering and rubbing themselves with towels. Being so close to them made him feel hot. He wiped his brow with the back of his hand. All he had to do to complete the fantasy was get them all scared half to death. He made himself calm. He was not going to spoil it by hate. It needed a few minutes planning. When they had all disappeared, he padded along the corridor after the woman. Three doors led off it, one on either side and one at the end. The door on the right was the one the woman had taken. He checked the end door and found that it led to a big dusty room full of bulky machinery. Boilers and filters, he guessed, for the swimming pool. He stepped inside and closed the door behind him. There was a low, even electrical hum. He pictured a girl, delirious with fright, dressed only in her underwear. He imagined a bra and panties with a pattern of flowers, lying on the floor, staring up at him with terrified eyes as he unbuckled his belt. He savored the vision for a moment, smiling to himself. She was just a few yards away. Right now, she might be contemplating the evening ahead. Maybe she had a boyfriend and was thinking of letting him go all the way tonight. Or she could be a freshman, lonely and a little shy, with nothing to do on Sunday night but watch Columbo. Or perhaps she had a paper to deliver tomorrow and was planning to stay up all night finishing it. None of the above, baby. It's nightmare time. He had done this kind of thing before, though never on such a scale. He had always loved to frighten girls, ever since he could remember. In high school, there was nothing he liked better than to get a girl on her own, in a corner somewhere, and threaten her until she cried and begged for mercy. That was why he kept having to move from one school to another. He dated girls sometimes, just to be like the other guys and have someone to walk into the bar on his arm. If they seemed to expect it, he would bone them, but it always seemed kind of pointless. Everyone had a kink, he figured. Some men liked to put on women's clothing. Others had to have a girl dressed in leather walk all over them with spike heels. One guy he knew thought the sexiest part of a woman was her feet. He got a hard-on standing in the women's footwear section of a department store, watching them put on shoes and take them off again. His kink was fear. What turned him on was a woman trembling with fright. Without fear, there was no excitement. Looking around methodically, he took note of a ladder fixed to the wall, leading up to an iron hatch bolted on the inside. He went quickly up the ladder, slid back the bolts, and pushed up the hatch. He found himself staring at the tires of a Chrysler New Yorker in a parking lot. Orienting himself, he figured he was at the back of the building. He closed the hatch and climbed down. He left the pool machine room. As he walked along the corridor, a woman coming the other way gave him a hostile stare. He suffered a moment of anxiety. She might ask him what the hell he was doing hanging around the women's locker room. An altercation like that was not in his scenario. At this point, it could spoil his plan. But her eyes lifted to his cap and took in the word security, and she looked away and turned into the locker room. He grinned. He had bought the cap for $8.99 in a souvenir store, but people were used to seeing guards in jeans at rock concerts, detectives who looked like criminals until they flashed their badges, airport police in sweaters. It was too much trouble to question the credentials of every asshole who called himself a security guard. He tried the door opposite the women's locker room. It opened into a small storeroom. He hit the light switch and closed the door behind him. Obsolete gym equipment was stacked around him on racks. Big black medicine balls, worn rubber mats, Indian clubs, moldy boxing gloves, and splintered wooden folding chairs. There was a vaulting horse with burst upholstery and a broken leg. The room smelled musty. A large silver pipe ran along the ceiling, and he guessed it provided ventilation to the locker room across the corridor. He reached up and tried the bolts that attached the pipe to what looked like a fan. He could not turn them with his fingers, but he had a wrench in the trunk of the Datsun. If he could detach the pipe, the fan would draw air from the storeroom instead of from the outside of the building. He would make his fire just below the fan. He would get a can of gasoline and pour some into an empty Perrier bottle and bring it down here along with some matches and a newspaper for kindling, and that wrench. The fire would grow quickly and produce huge billows of smoke. He would tie a wet rag over his nose and mouth and wait until the storeroom was full of it. Then he would detach the ventilator pipe. The fumes would be drawn into the duct and pumped out into the women's locker room. At first, no one would notice. Then one or two would sniff the air and say, "Is someone smoking?" He would open the storeroom door and let the corridor fill with smoke. When the girls realized something was seriously wrong, they would open the locker room door and think the whole building was on fire. And they would all panic. Then he would walk into the locker room. There would be a sea of brassieres and stockings, bare breasts and asses and pubic hair. Some would be running out of the showers, naked and wet, fumbling for towels. Others would be trying to pull on clothes. Most would be running around searching for the door, half blinded by smoke. There would be screams and sobs and shouts of fear. He would continue to pretend to be a security guard and yell orders at them. "Don't stop to dress. This is an emergency. Get out. The whole building is blazing. Run, run!" He would smack their bare asses, shove them around, snatch their clothes away, and feel them up. They would know something was badly wrong, but most of them would be too crazy to figure it out. If the muscular hockey captain was still there, she might have the presence of mind to challenge him, but he would just punch her out. Walking around, he would select his main victim. She would be a pretty girl with a vulnerable look. He would take her arm, saying, "This way, please. I'm with security." He would lead her into the corridor, then turn the wrong way, to the pool machine room. Then, just when she thought she was on the way to safety, he would smack her face and punch her in the gut and throw her on the dirty concrete floor. He would watch her roll and turn and sit upright, gasping and sobbing and looking at him with terror in her eyes. Then he would smile and unbuckle his belt. 2. Mrs. Farami said, "I want to go home." Her daughter Jeannie said, "Don't you worry, Mom. We're going to get you out of here sooner than you think." Jeannie's younger sister Patty shot Jeannie a look that said, "How the hell do you think we're going to do that?" The Bella Vista Sunset home was all Mom's health insurance would pay for, and it was tawdry. The room contained 2 high hospital beds, 2 closets, a couch, and a TV. The walls were painted mushroom brown, and the flooring was a plastic tile, cream streaked with orange. The window had bars but no curtains, and it looked out onto a gas station. There was a wash basin in the corner, and a toilet down the hall. "I want to go home," Mom repeated. Patty said, "But, Mom, you keep forgetting things. You can't take care of yourself anymore." "Of course I can. Don't you dare speak to me that way." Jeannie bit her lip. Looking at the wreck that used to be her mother, she wanted to cry. Mom had strong features, black eyebrows, dark eyes, a straight nose, a wide mouth, and a strong chin. The same pattern was repeated in both Jeannie and Patty, although Mom was small, and they were both tall like Daddy. All 3 of them were as strong-minded as their look suggested. Formidable was the word usually used to describe the Farami women. But Mom would never be formidable again. She had Alzheimer's. She was not yet 60. Jeannie, who was 29, and Patty, 26, had hoped she could take care of herself for a few more years. But that hope had been shattered this morning at 5 a.m. when a Washington cop had called to say he had found Mom walking along 18th Street in a grubby nightgown, crying and saying she could not remember where she lived. Jeannie had got in her car and driven to Washington, an hour from Baltimore on a quiet Sunday morning. She had picked Mom up from the precinct house, taken her home, gotten her washed and dressed, then called Patty. Together, the two sisters had made arrangements for Mom to check into Bella Vista. It was in the town of Columbia, between Washington and Baltimore. Their Aunt Rosa had spent her declining years here. Aunt Rosa had had the same insurance policy as Mom. "I don't like this place," Mom said. Jeannie said, "We don't either, but right now it's all we can afford." She intended to sound matter-of-fact and reasonable, but it came out harsh. Patty shot her a reproving look and said, "Come on, Mom, we've lived in worse places." It was true. After their father went to jail the second time, the two girls and Mom had lived in one room with a hot plate on the dresser and a water tap in the corridor. Those were the welfare years. But Mom had been a lioness in adversity. As soon as both Jeannie and Patty were in school, she found a trustworthy older woman to mind the girls when they came home. She got a job. She had been a hairdresser, and she was still good, if old-fashioned, and she moved them to a small apartment with two bedrooms in Adams Morgan, which was then a respectable working-class neighborhood. She would fix French toast for breakfast and send Jeannie and Patty to school in clean dresses, then do her hair and make up her face. You had to look smart working in a salon, and always leave a spotless kitchen with a plate of cookies on the table for the girls when they came back. On Sundays, the three of them cleaned the apartment and did the laundry together. Mom had always been so capable, so reliable, so tireless. It was heartbreaking to see the forgetful, complaining woman on the bed. Now she frowned, as if puzzled, and said, "Jeannie, why have you got a ring in your nose?" Jeannie touched the delicate silver band and gave a wan smile. "Mom, I had my nostril pierced when I was a kid. Don't you remember how mad you got about it? I thought you were going to throw me out on the street." "I forget things," Mom said. "I sure remember," said Patty. "I thought it was the greatest thing ever. But I was 11, and you were 14, and to me everything you did was bold and stylish and clever." "Maybe it was," Jeannie said with mock vanity. Patty giggled. "The orange jacket sure wasn't." "Oh, God, that jacket. Mom finally burned it after I slept in it in an abandoned building and got fleas." "I remember that," Mom said. "Fleas! A child of mine!" She was still indignant about it, 15 years later. Suddenly the mood was lighter. Reminiscing had reminded them of how close they were. It was a good moment to leave. "I'd better go," Jeannie said, standing up. "Me too," said Patty. "I have to make dinner." However, neither woman moved toward the door. Jeannie felt she was abandoning her mother, deserting her in a time of need. Nobody here loved her. She should have family to look after her. Jeannie and Patty should stay with her and cook for her and iron her nightgowns and turn the TV to her favorite show. Mom said, "When will I see you?" Jeannie hesitated. She wanted to say, "Tomorrow I'll bring you your breakfast and stay with you all day." But it was impossible. She had a busy week at work. Guilt flooded her. "How can I be so cruel?" Patty rescued her, saying, "I'll come tomorrow and bring the kids to see you. You'll like that." Mom was not going to let Jeannie get off that easily. "Will you come too, Jeannie?" Jeannie could hardly speak. "As soon as I can." Choking with grief, she leaned over the bed and kissed her mother. "I love you, Mom. Try to remember that." The moment they were outside the door, Patty burst into tears. Jeannie felt like crying, too, but she was the older sister, and she had long ago gotten into the habit of controlling her own emotions while she took care of Patty. She put an arm around her sister's shoulders as they walked along the antiseptic corridor. Patty was not weak, but she was more accepting than Jeannie, who was combative and willful. Mom always criticized Jeannie and said she should be more like Patty. "I wish I could have her at home with me, but I can't," Patty said woefully. Jeannie agreed. Patty was married to a carpenter called Zip. They lived in a small row house with two bedrooms. The second bedroom was shared by her three boys. Davy was 6, Mel 4, and Tom 2. There was nowhere to put a grandma. Jeannie was single. As an assistant professor at Jones Falls University, she earned $30,000 a year. A lot less than Patty's husband, she guessed, and she had just taken out her first mortgage and bought a two-room apartment and furnished it on credit. One room was a living room with a kitchen nook, the other a bedroom with a closet and a tiny bathroom. If she gave Mom her bed, she would have to sleep on the couch every night, and there was no one at home during the day to keep an eye on a woman with Alzheimer's. "I can't take her either," she said. Patty showed anger through her tears. "So why did you tell her we would get her out of there? We can't!" They stepped outside into the torrid heat. Jeannie said, "Tomorrow I'll go to the bank and get a loan. We'll put her in a better place, and I'll add to the insurance money."
"But how will you ever pay it back?" said Patty practically.
"I'll get promoted to associate professor, then full professor, and I'll be commissioned to write a textbook and get hired as a consultant by 3 international conglomerates." Patty smiled through her tears. "I believe you, but will the bank?" Patty had always believed in Jeannie. Patty herself had never been ambitious. She had been below average at school and had married at 19 and settled down to raise children without any apparent regrets. Jeannie was the opposite, top of the class and captain of all sports teams. She had been a tennis champion and had put herself through college on sports scholarships. Whatever she said she was going to do, Patty never doubted her. But Patty was right. The bank would not make another loan so soon after financing the purchase of her apartment, and she had only just started as assistant professor. It would be 3 years before she was considered for promotion. As they reached the parking lot, Jeannie said desperately, "Okay, I'll sell my car." She loved her car. It was a 20-year-old Mercedes 230C, a red 2-door sedan with black leather seats. She had bought it 8 years ago with her prize money for winning the Mayfair Lights College Tennis Challenge. $5,000. That was before it became chic to own an old Mercedes. "It's probably worth double what I paid for it," she said.
"But you'd have to buy another car," Patty said, still remorselessly realistic.
"You're right." Jeannie sighed. "Well, I can do some private tutoring. It's against JFU's rules, but I can probably get $40 an hour teaching remedial statistics one-on-one with rich students who have flunked the exam at other universities. I could pick up $300 a week, maybe. Tax-free if I don't declare it."
She looked her sister in the eye.
"Can you spare anything?"
Patty looked away. "I don't know."
"Zip makes more than I do."
"He'll kill me for saying this, but we might be able to chip in 75 or 80 a week," Patty said at last. "I'll get him to put in for a raise. He's kind of timid about asking, but I know he deserves it, and his boss likes him."
Jeannie began to feel more cheerful, although the prospect of spending her Sundays teaching backward undergraduates was dismal. "For an extra $400 a week, we might get Mom a room to herself with her own bathroom. Then she could have more of her things about her, ornaments and maybe some furniture from the apartment." "Let's ask around, see if anyone knows of a nice place."
"Okay." Patty was thoughtful. "Mom's illness is inherited, isn't it? I saw something on TV."
Jeannie nodded. "There's a gene defect, AD3, that's linked to early onset Alzheimer's. It was located at chromosome 14Q24.3, Jeannie recalled. But that would not mean anything to Patty.
"Does that mean you and I will end up like Mom?"
"It means there's a good chance we will."
They were both silent for a moment. The thought of losing your mind was almost too grim to talk about.
"I'm glad I had my children young," Patty said. "They'll be old enough to look after themselves by the time it happens to me." Jeannie noted the hint of reproof. Like Mom, Patty thought there was something wrong with being 29 and childless. Jeannie said, "The fact that they found the gene is also hopeful. It means that by the time we're Mom's age, they may be able to inject us with an altered version of our own DNA that doesn't have the fatal gene. They mentioned that on TV. Recombinant DNA technology, right?" Jeannie grinned at her sister.
"Right.
See, I'm not so dumb."
"I never thought you were dumb."
Patty said thoughtfully, "The thing is, our DNA makes us what we are. So if you change my DNA, does that make me a different person?"
It's not just your DNA that makes you what you are. It's your upbringing, too. That's what my work is all about. How's the new job going?
It's exciting. This is my big chance, Patty. A lot of people read the article I wrote about criminality and whether it's in our genes. The article, published last year while she was still at the University of Minnesota, had borne the name of her supervising professor above her own. But she had done the work. I could never figure out whether you said criminality is inherited or not. I identified four inherited traits that lead to criminal behavior. Impulsiveness, fearlessness, aggression, and hyperactivity. But my big theory is that certain ways of raising children counteract those traits and turn potential criminals into good citizens.
How could you ever prove a thing like that?
By studying identical twins raised apart. Identical twins have the same DNA, but when they're adopted at birth or split up for some other reason, they get raised differently. So I look for pairs of twins where one is a criminal and the other is normal. Then I study how they were raised and what their parents did differently.
Your work is really important, Patty said.
I think so. We have to find out why so many Americans nowadays turn bad.
Jeannie nodded.
That was it, in a nutshell. Patty turned to her own car, a big old Ford station wagon, the back full of brightly colored kitty junk, a tricycle, a folded-down stroller, an assortment of rackets and balls, and a big toy truck with a broken wheel.
Jeannie said, "Give the boys a big kiss from me, okay?"
"Thanks. I'll call you tomorrow after I see Mom." Jeannie got her keys out, hesitated, then went over to Patty and hugged her.
"I love you, sis," she said.
"Love you, too."
Jeannie got in her car and drove away. She felt jangled and restless, full of unresolved feelings about Mom and Patty and the father who was not there. She got on I-70 and drove too fast, weaving in and out of the traffic. She wondered what to do with the rest of the day, then remembered that she was supposed to play tennis at 6, then go for beer and pizza with a group of graduate students and young faculty from the psychology department at Jones Falls. Her first thought was to cancel the entire evening, but she did not want to sit at home brooding. She would play tennis, she decided. The vigorous exercise would make her feel better. Afterward, she would go to Andy's bar for an hour or so, then have an early night. But it did not work out that way. Her tennis opponent was Jack Budgeon, the university's head librarian. He had once played at Wimbledon, and though he was now bald and 50, he was still fit, and all the old craft was there. Jeannie had never been to Wimbledon. The height of her career had been a place on the U.S. Olympic tennis team when she was an undergraduate. But she was stronger and faster than Jack. They played on one of the red clay tennis courts on the Jones Falls campus. They were evenly matched, and the game attracted a small crowd of spectators. There was no dress code, but out of habit, Jeannie always played in crisp white shorts and a white polo shirt. She had long, dark hair, not silky and straight like Patty's, but curly and unmanageable, so she tucked it up inside a peaked cap. Jeannie's serve was dynamite, and her two-handed cross-court backhand smash was a killer. There was not much Jack could do about the serve, but after the first few games, he made sure she did not get many chances to use the backhand smash. He played a sly game, conserving his energy, letting Jeannie make mistakes. She played too aggressively, serving double faults and running to the net too early. On a normal day, she reckoned, she could beat him, but today her concentration was shot and she could not second-guess his game. They won a set each, then the third went to 5-4 in his favor, and she found herself serving to stay in the match. The game went to 2 deuces, then Jack won a point, and the advantage was to him. Jeannie served into the net, and there was an audible gasp from the little crowd. Instead of a normal, slower second serve, she threw caution to the winds and served again as if it were a first service. Jack just got his racket to the ball and returned it to her backhand. She smashed it and ran to the net. But Jack was not as off balance as he had pretended to be, and he returned a perfect lob that sailed over her head and landed on the back line to win the match. Jeannie stood looking at the ball, hands on her hips, furious with herself. Although she had not played seriously for years,
She retained the unyielding competitiveness that made it hard to lose. Then she calmed her feelings and put a smile on her face. She turned around. "Beautiful shot," she called. She walked to the net and shook his hand, and there was a ragged round of applause from the spectators. A young man approached her. "Hey, that was a great game," he said with a broad smile. Jeannie took him in at a glance. He was a hunk, tall and athletic, with curly fair hair cut short and nice blue eyes, and he was coming on to her for all he was worth. She was not in the mood. "Thanks," she said curtly. He smiled again, a confident, relaxed smile that said most girls were happy when he talked to them, regardless of whether he was making any sense. "You know, I play a little tennis myself, and I was thinking..." "If you only play a little tennis, you're probably not in my league," she said, and she brushed past him. Behind her, she heard him say in a good-humored tone, "Should I assume that a romantic dinner followed by a night of passion is out of the question, then?" She could not help smiling, if only at his persistence, and she had been ruder than necessary. She turned her head and spoke over her shoulder without stopping. "Yeah, but thanks for the offer," she said. She left the court and headed for the locker room. She wondered what Mom was doing now. She must have had dinner by this time. It was 7:30, and they always fed people early in institutions. She was probably watching TV in the lounge. Maybe she would find a friend, a woman of her own age who would tolerate her forgetfulness and take an interest in her photographs of her grandchildren. Mom had once had a lot of friends, the other women at the salon, some of her customers, neighbors, people she had known for 25 years. But it was hard for them to keep up the friendship when Mom kept forgetting who the hell they were. As she was passing the hockey field, she ran into Lisa Hoxton. Lisa was the first real friend she had made since arriving at Jones Falls a month ago. She was a technician in the psychology laboratory. She had a science degree, but did not want to be an academic. Like Jeannie, she came from a poor background, and she was a little intimidated by the Ivy League auteur of Jones Falls. They had taken to one another instantly. "A kid just tried to pick me up," Jeannie said with a smile. "What was he like?" "He looked like Brad Pitt, but taller." "Did you tell him you had a friend more his age?" Lisa said. She was 24. "No." Jeannie glanced over her shoulder, but the man was nowhere in sight. "Keep walking, in case he follows me." "How could that be bad?" "Come on. Jeannie, it's the creepy ones you run away from." "Knock it off. You might have given him my phone number." "I should have handed him a slip of paper with your bra size on it. That would have done the trick." Lisa had a big bust. Lisa stopped walking. For a moment, Jeannie thought she had gone too far and offended Lisa. She began to frame an apology. Then Lisa said, "What a great idea! I'm a 36D. For more information, call this number." "It's so subtle, too." "I'm just envious. I always wanted Hooters," Jeannie said, and they both giggled. "It's true, though. I prayed for tips. I was practically the last girl in my class to get my period. It was so embarrassing." "You actually said, 'Dear God, please make my tits grow,' kneeling beside your bed?" "Actually, I prayed to the Virgin Mary. I figured it was a girl thing. And I didn't say tits, of course." "What did you say? Breasts?" "No. I figured you couldn't say breasts to the Holy Mother." "So what did you call them?" "Bristles." Lisa burst out laughing. "I don't know where I got that word from. I must have overheard some men talking. It seemed like a polite euphemism to me. I never told anyone that before in my life." Lisa looked back. "Well, I don't see any good-looking guys following us. I guess we shook off Brad Pitt." "It's a good thing. He's just my type. Handsome, sexy, overconfident, and totally untrustworthy." "How do you know he's untrustworthy? You only met him for 20 seconds. "All men are untrustworthy." "You're probably right. Are you coming to Andy's tonight?" "Yeah, just for an hour or so. I have to shower first." Her shirt was wet through with perspiration. "Me too. Lisa was in shorts and running shoes. I've been training with a hockey team. Why only for an hour? I've had a heavy day. The game had distracted Jeannie, but now she winced as the agony came flooding back. I had to put my mom into a home. Oh, Jeannie, I'm sorry. Jeannie told her the story as they entered the gymnasium building and went down the stairs to the basement. In the locker room, Jeannie caught sight of their reflection in the mirror. They were so different in appearance that they almost looked like a comedy act. Lisa was a little below average height, and Jeannie was almost 6 feet. Lisa was blonde and curvy, whereas Jeannie was dark and muscular. Lisa had a pretty face, with a scatter of freckles across a pert little nose and a mouth like a bow. Most people described Jeannie as striking, and men sometimes told her she was beautiful, but nobody ever called her pretty. As they climbed out of their sweaty sports clothes, Lisa said, "What about your father? You didn't mention him." Jeannie sighed. It was the question she had learned to dread, even as a little girl, but it invariably came, sooner or later. For many years she had lied, saying Daddy was dead or disappeared or remarried and gone to work in Saudi Arabia. Lately, however, she had been telling the truth. "My father's in jail," she said. "Oh, my God! I shouldn't have asked. It's okay. He's been in jail most of my life. He's a burglar. This is his third term." "How long is his sentence?" "I don't remember. It doesn't matter. He'll be no use when he comes out. He's never looked after us, and he's not about to begin." "Did he never have a regular job?" "Only when he wanted to case a joint. He would work as janitor, doorman, security guard for a week or two before robbing the place." Lisa looked at her shrewdly. "Is that why you're so interested in the genetics of criminality?" "Maybe." "Probably not." Lisa made a tossing aside gesture. "I hate amateur psychoanalysis anyway." They went to the showers. Jeannie took longer, washing her hair. She was grateful for Lisa's friendship. Lisa had been at Jones Falls just over a year, and she had shown Jeannie around when she had arrived here at the beginning of the semester. Jeannie liked working with Lisa in the lab because she was completely reliable, and she liked hanging out with her after work because she felt she could say whatever came into her mind without fear of shocking her. Jeannie was working conditioner into her hair when she heard strange noises. She stopped and listened. It sounded like squeals of fright. A chill of anxiety passed through her, making her shiver. Suddenly, she felt very vulnerable, naked, wet, underground. She hesitated, then quickly rinsed her hair before stepping out of the shower to see what was going on. She smelled burning as soon as she got out from under the water. She could not see a fire, but there were thick clouds of black and gray smoke close to the ceiling. It seemed to be coming through the ventilators. She felt afraid. She had never been in a fire. The more cool-headed women were snatching up their bags and heading for the door. Others were getting hysterical, shouting at one another in frightened voices and running here and there pointlessly. Some asshole of a security man, with a spotted handkerchief tied over his nose and mouth, was making them more scared by walking up and down, shoving people and yelling orders. Jeannie knew she should not stay to get dressed, but she could not bring herself to walk out of the building naked. There was fear running through her veins like ice water, but she made herself calm. She found her locker. Lisa was nowhere to be seen. She grabbed her clothes, stepped into her jeans, and pulled her T-shirt over her head. It took only a few seconds, but in that time, the room emptied of people and filled with fumes. She could no longer see the doorway, and she started to cough. The thought of not being able to breathe scared her. "I know where the door is, and I just have to keep calm," she told herself. Her keys and money were in her jeans pockets. She picked up her tennis racket. Holding her breath, she walked quickly through the lockers to the exit. The corridor was thick with smoke, and her eyes began to water so that she was almost blind. Now she wished to heaven that she had gone naked and gained a few precious seconds. Her jeans did not help her see or breathe in this fog of fumes, and it did not matter being naked if you were dead. She kept one shaky hand on the wall to give her a sense of direction as she rushed along the passage, still holding her breath. She thought she might bump into other women, but they all seemed to have got out ahead of her. When there was no more wall, she knew she was in the small lobby, although she could not see anything but clouds of smoke. The stairs had to be straight ahead. She crossed the lobby and crashed into the Coke machine. Was the staircase to the left now or the right? The left, she thought. She moved that way, then came up against the door to the men's locker room and realized she had made the wrong choice. She could not hold her breath any longer. With a groan, she sucked in air. It was mostly smoke, and it made her cough convulsively. She staggered back along the wall, racked with coughing, her nostrils burning, eyes streaming, barely able to see her own hands in front of her. With all her being, she longed for one breath of the air she had been taking for granted for 29 years. She followed the wall to the Coke machine and stepped around it. She knew she had found the staircase when she tripped over the bottom step. She dropped her racket, and it slid out of sight. It was the special one. She had won the Mayfair Lights Challenge with it, but she left it behind and scrambled up the stairs on hands and knees. The smoke thinned suddenly when she reached the spacious ground-floor lobby. She could see the building doors, which were open. A security guard stood just outside, beckoning her and yelling, "Come on!" Coughing and choking, she staggered across the lobby and out into the blessed fresh air. She stood on the steps for 2 or 3 minutes, bent double, gulping air and coughing the smoke out of her lungs. As her breathing at last began to return to normal, she heard the whoop of an emergency vehicle in the distance. She looked around for Lisa, but could not see her. Surely she could not be inside. Still feeling shaky, Jeannie moved through the crowd, scanning the faces. Now that they were out of danger, there was a good deal of nervous laughter. Most of the students were more or less undressed, so there was a curiously intimate atmosphere. Those who had managed to save their bags were lending spare clothes to others less fortunate. Naked women were grateful for their friends' soiled and sweaty T-shirts. Several people were dressed only in towels. Lisa was not in the crowd. With mounting anxiety, Jeannie returned to the security guard at the door. "I think my girlfriend may be in there," she said, hearing the tremor of fear in her own voice. "I ain't going after her," he said quickly. "Brave man," Jeannie snapped. She was not sure what she wanted him to do, but she had not expected him to be completely useless. Resentment showed on his face. "That's their job," he said, and he pointed to a fire truck coming down the road. Jeannie was beginning to fear for Lisa's life, but she did not know what to do. She watched, impatient and helpless, as the firemen got out of the truck and put on breathing apparatus. They seemed to move so slowly that she wanted to shake them and scream, "Hurry, hurry!" Another fire truck arrived, then a white police cruiser with the blue and white stripe of the Baltimore Police Department. As the firemen dragged a hose into the building, an officer buttonholed the lobby guard and said, "Where do you think it started?" "Women's locker room," the guard told him. "And where is that exactly?" "Basement at the back." "How many exits are there from the basement?" "Only one. The staircase up to the main lobby, right here." A maintenance man standing nearby contradicted him. "There's a ladder in the pool machine room that leads up to an access hatch at the back of the building." Jeannie caught the officer's attention and said, "I think my friend may still be inside there." "Man or woman?" "Woman of 24, short, blonde. If she's there, we'll find her." For a moment, Jeannie felt reassured. Then she realized he had not promised to find her alive. The security man who had been in the locker room was nowhere to be seen. Jeannie said to the fire officer, "There was another guard down there. I don't see him anywhere. Tall guy." The lobby guard said, "There ain't no other security personnel in the building." "Well, he had a hat with security written on it, and he was telling people to evacuate the building." "I don't care what he had on his hat." "Oh, for Pete's sake, stop arguing," Jeannie snapped. "Maybe I imagined him, but if not, his life could be in danger." Standing listening to them was a girl wearing a man's khaki pants rolled up at the cuffs. "I saw that guy. He's a real creep," she said. "He felt me up." The fire officer said, "Keep calm. We'll find everyone. Thank you for your cooperation." He walked off. Jeannie glared at the lobby guard for a moment. She felt the fire officer had dismissed her as a hysterical woman because she had yelled at the guard. She turned away in disgust. What was she going to do now? The firemen ran inside in their helmets and boots. She was barefoot and wearing a T-shirt. If she tried to go in with them, they would throw her out. She clenched her fists, distraught. Think, think, where else could Lisa be? The gymnasium was next door to the Ruth W. Acorn Psychology Building, named after the wife of a benefactor, but known, even to faculty, as Nuthouse. Could Lisa have gone in there? The doors would be locked on Sunday, but she probably had a key. She might have run inside to find a laboratory coat to cover herself, or just to sit at her desk and recover. Jeannie decided to check. Anything was better than standing here doing nothing. She dashed across the lawn to the main entrance of Nuthouse and looked through the glass doors. There was no one in the lobby. She took from her pocket the plastic card that served as a key and swiped it through the card reader. The door opened. She ran up the stairs, calling, "Lisa, are you there?" The laboratory was deserted. Lisa's chair was tucked neatly under her desk, and her computer screen was a gray blank. Jeannie tried the women's restroom at the end of the corridor. Nothing. "Damn," she said frantically. "Where the hell are you?" Panting, she hurried back outside. She decided to make a tour of the gymnasium building, in case Lisa was just sitting on the ground somewhere, catching her breath. She ran around the side of the building, passing through a yard full of giant garbage cans. At the back was a small parking lot. She saw a figure jogging along the footpath, heading away. It was too tall to be Lisa, and she was pretty sure it was a man. She thought it might be the missing security guard, but he disappeared around the corner of the student union before she could be sure. She continued around the building. At the far side was the running track, deserted now. Coming full circle, she arrived at the front of the gym. The crowd was bigger, and there were more fire engines and police cars, but she still could not see Lisa. It seemed almost certain that she was still in the burning building. A sense of doom crept over Jeannie, and she fought it. You can't just let this happen. She spotted the fire officer she had spoken to earlier. She grabbed his arm. I'm almost certain Lisa Hoxton is in there, she said urgently. I've looked everywhere for her. He gave her a hard look and seemed to decide she was reliable. Without answering her, he put a two-way radio to his mouth. Look out for a young white female believed to be inside the building, named Lisa. Repeat, Lisa. Thank you, Jeannie said. He nodded curtly and strode away. Jeannie was glad he had listened to her, but still she could not rest. Lisa might be stuck in there, locked in a toilet or trapped by flames, screaming for help unheard. Or she might have fallen and struck her head and knocked herself out, or succumbed to the fumes and be lying unconscious with the fire creeping closer by the second. Jeannie remembered the maintenance man saying there was another entrance to the basement. She had not seen it as she ran around the outside of the gym. She decided to look again. She returned to the back of the building. She saw it immediately. The hatch was set into the ground close to the building, partly hidden by a gray Chrysler New Yorker. The steel trap door was open, leaning against the building wall. Jeannie knelt by the square hole and leaned down to look inside. A ladder led down to a dirty room, lit by fluorescent tubes. She could see machinery and lots of pipes. There were wisps of smoke in the air, but not thick clouds. It must be closed off from the rest of the basement. Nevertheless, the smell of the smoke reminded her of how she had coughed and choked as she had searched blindly for the staircase, and she felt her heart beat faster at the memory. "Is anybody there?" she called. She thought she heard a sound, but could not be sure. She shouted louder, "Hello?" There was no reply. She hesitated. The sensible thing to do would be to return to the front of the building and grab a fireman, but that could take too long, especially if the fireman decided to question her. The alternative was to go down the ladder and take a look. The thought of re-entering the building made her legs weak. Her chest still hurt from the violent spasms of coughing caused by the smoke. But Lisa might be down there, hurt and unable to move, or trapped by a fallen timber, or just passed out. She had to look. She steeled her nerve and put a foot on the ladder. Her knees felt weak and she almost fell. She hesitated. After a moment, she felt stronger, and she took a step down. Then a breath of smoke caught in her throat, making her cough, and she climbed out again. When she stopped coughing, she tried again. She went down one rung, then two. If the smoke makes me cough, I'll just come right out again, she told herself. The third step was easier, and after that she went down quickly, jumping off the last rung onto the concrete floor. She found herself in a big room full of pumps and filters, presumably for the swimming pool. The smell of smoke was strong, but she could breathe normally. She saw Lisa right away, and the sight made her gasp. She was lying on her side, curled up in the fetal position, naked. There was a smear of what looked like blood on her thigh. She was not moving. For a moment, Jeannie was rigid with fear. She tried to get hold of herself. Lisa! She shouted. She heard the shrill overtone of hysteria in her own voice and took a breath to keep calm. Please, God, let her be all right. She made her way across the room, through the tangle of pipework, and knelt beside her friend. Lisa? Lisa opened her eyes. Thank God, Jeannie said. I thought you were dead. Slowly, Lisa sat up. She would not look at Jeannie. Her lips were bruised. He raped me, she said. Jeannie's relief at finding her alive was replaced by a thick feeling of horror that gripped her heart. My God! Here? Lisa nodded. He said this was the way out. Jeannie closed her eyes. She felt Lisa's pain and humiliation, the sense of being invaded and violated and soiled. Tears came to her eyes, and she held them back fiercely. For a moment, she was too weak and nauseated to say anything. Then she tried to pull herself together. Who was he? A security guy. With a spotted scarf over his face? He took it off. Lisa turned away. He kept smiling. It figured. The girl in khaki pants had said a security guard felt her up. The lobby guard was sure there were no other security people in the building. He was no security guard, Jeannie said. She had seen him jogging away just a few minutes ago. A wave of rage swept over her at the thought that he had done this dreadful thing right here, on the campus, in the gymnasium building, where they all felt safe to take off their clothes and shower. It made her hands shake, and she wanted to chase after him and strangle him. She heard loud noises, men shouting, heavy footsteps, and the rush of water. The firemen were operating their hoses. Listen, we're in danger here, she said urgently. We have to get out of this building. Lisa's voice was a dull monotone. I don't have any clothes. We could die in here. Don't worry about clothes. Everyone's half naked out there. Jeannie scanned the room hastily and saw Lisa's red lace brassiere and panties in a dusty heap beneath a tank. She picked him up. Put your underwear on. It's dirty, but it's better than nothing. Lisa remained sitting on the floor, staring vacantly. Jeannie fought down a feeling of panic. What could she do if Lisa refused to move? She could probably lift Lisa, but could she carry her up that ladder? She raised her voice. Come on, get up! Taking Lisa's hands, she pulled her to her feet. At last, Lisa met her eyes. Jeannie, it was horrible, she said. Jeannie put her arms around Lisa's shoulders and hugged her hard. I'm sorry, Lisa. I'm so sorry, she said. The smoke was becoming more dense, despite the heavy door. Fear replaced pity in her heart. We have to get out of here. The place is burning down. For God's sake, put these on! At last, Lisa began to move. She pulled up her panties and fastened her bra. Jeannie took her hand and led her to the ladder on the wall, then made her go up first. As Jeannie followed, the door crashed open, and a fireman entered in a cloud of smoke. Water swirled around his boots. He looked startled to see them. We're all right. We're getting out this way, Jeannie yelled to him. Then she went up the ladder after Lisa. A moment later, they were outside in the fresh air. Jeannie felt weak with relief. She had got Lisa out of the fire. But now Lisa needed help. Jeannie put an arm around her shoulders and led her to the front of the building. There were fire trucks and police cruisers parked every which way across the road. Most of the women in the crowd had now found something with which to cover their nakedness, and Lisa was conspicuous in her red underwear. "Does anyone have a pair of spare pants or anything at all?" Jeannie begged as they made their way through the crowd. People had given away all their spare clothing. Jeannie would have given Lisa her own sweatshirt, but she had no bra on underneath. Finally, a tall black man took off his button-down and gave it to Lisa. "I want it back. It's a Ralph Lauren," he said. "Mitchell Waterfield, Math Department." "I'll remember," Jeannie said gratefully. Lisa put the shirt on. She was short, and it reached to her knees. Jeannie felt she was getting the nightmare under control. She steered Lisa to the emergency vehicles. Three cops stood leaning against a cruiser, doing nothing. Jeannie spoke to the oldest of the three, a fat white man with a gray mustache. "This woman's name is Lisa Hoxton. She's been raped." She expected them to be electrified by the news that a major crime had been committed, but their reaction was surprisingly casual. They took a few seconds to digest the information, and Jeannie was getting ready to snap at them when the one with the mustache levered himself off the hood of the car and said, "Where did this happen?" "The basement of the burning building, in the pool machine room at the back." One of the others, a young black man, said, "Those firemen will be hosing away the evidence right now, Sarge." "You're right," the older man replied. "You better get down there, Lenny, and secure the crime scene." Lenny hurried away. The sergeant turned to Lisa. "Do you know the man who did this, Ms. Hoxton?" he said. Lisa shook her head. Jeannie said, "He's a tall white man wearing a red baseball cap with the word security on the front. I saw him in the women's locker room soon after the fire broke out, and I think I saw him running away just before I found Lisa." The cop reached into the car and pulled out a radio microphone. He spoke into it for a while, then hung it up again. "If he's dumb enough to keep the hat on, we may catch him," he said. He spoke to the third cop. "McKenty, take the victim to the hospital." McKenty was a young white man with glasses. He said to Lisa, "You want to sit in the front or the back?" Lisa said nothing, but looked apprehensive. Jeannie helped her out. "Sit in the front. You don't want to look like a suspect." A terrified look crossed Lisa's face, and she spoke at last. "Aren't you coming with me?" "I will, if you like," Jeannie said reassuringly. "Or I could swing by my apartment and pick up some clothes for you and meet you at the hospital." Lisa looked at McKenty worriedly. Jeannie said, "You'll be all right now, Lisa." McKenty held open the door of the cruiser, and Lisa got in. "Which hospital?" Jeannie asked him. "Santa Teresa." He got in the car. "I'll be there in a few minutes," Jeannie called through the glass as the car sped away. She jogged to the faculty parking lot, already regretting that she had not gone with Lisa. Her expression as she left had been frightened and wretched. Of course she needed clean clothes, but maybe she had a more urgent need for another woman to stay with her and hold her hand and reassure her. Probably the last thing she wanted was to be left alone with a macho man with a gun. As she jumped into her car, Jeannie felt she had screwed up. "Jesus, what a day," she said, as she tore out of the parking lot. She lived not far from the campus. Her apartment was the upper story of a small row house. Jeannie double-parked and ran inside. She washed her hands and face hurriedly, then threw on some clean clothes. She thought for a moment about which of her clothes would fit Lisa's short, rounded figure. She pulled out an oversized polo shirt and a pair of sweatpants with an elastic waistband. Underwear was more difficult. She found a baggy pair of man's boxer shorts that might do, but none of her bras would fit. Lisa would have to go without. She added deck shoes, stuffed everything into a duffel, and ran out again. As she drove to the hospital, her mood changed. Since the fire broke out, she had been focused on what she had to do. Now she began to feel enraged. Lisa was a happy, garrulous woman, but the shock and horror of what had happened had turned her into a zombie, frightened to get into a police car on her own. Driving along a shopping street, Jeannie started to look for the guy in the red cap, imagining that if she saw him, she would swing the car up on the sidewalk and run him down. But in fact, she would not recognize him. He must have taken off the bandana, and probably the hat, too. What else had he been wearing? It shocked her to realize she could hardly remember. Some kind of T-shirt, she thought, with blue jeans, or maybe shorts. Anyway, he might have changed his clothes by now, as she had. In fact, it could be any tall white man on the street, that pizza delivery boy in the red coat, the bald guy walking to church with his wife, hymn books under their arms, the handsome bearded man carrying a guitar case, even the cop talking to a bum outside the liquor store. There was nothing Jeannie could do with her rage, and she gripped the steering wheel tighter until her knuckles turned white. Santa Teresa was a big suburban hospital near the northern city limits. Jeannie left her car in the parking lot and found the emergency room. Lisa was already in bed, wearing a hospital gown and staring into space. A TV set with the sound off was showing the Emmy Awards ceremony. Hundreds of Hollywood celebrities in evening dress, drinking champagne and congratulating one another. McKenty sat beside the bed with his notebook on his knee. Jeannie put down the duffel. "Here are your clothes. What's happening?" Lisa remained expressionless and silent. She was still in shock, Jeannie figured. She was suppressing her feelings, fighting to stay in control. But at some point she had to show her rage. There would be an explosion sooner or later. McKenty said, "I have to take down the basic details of the case, miss. Would you excuse us for a few more minutes?" "Oh, sure," Jeannie said apologetically. Then she caught a look from Lisa and hesitated. A few minutes ago, she had been cursing herself for leaving Lisa alone with a man. Now she was about to do it again. "On the other hand," she said, "maybe Lisa would prefer me to stay." Her instinct was confirmed when Lisa gave a barely perceptible nod. Jeannie sat on the bed and took Lisa's hand. McKenty looked irritated, but he did not argue. "I was asking Miss Hoxton about how she tried to resist the assault," he said. "Did you scream, Lisa?"
"Once, when he threw me on the floor," she said in a low voice. Then he pulled the knife. McKenty's voice was matter-of-fact, and he looked down at his notebook as he spoke.
"Did you try to fight him off?"
She shook her head. "I was afraid he would cut me."
"So you really didn't put up any resistance after that first scream?"
She shook her head and began to cry. Jeannie squeezed her hand. She wanted to say to McKenty, what the hell was she supposed to do? But she kept silent. Already today she had been rude to a boy who looked like Brad Pitt, made a bitchy remark about Lisa's boobs, and snapped at the lobby guard in the gym. She knew she was not good at dealing with authority figures, and she was determined not to make an enemy of this policeman, who was only trying to do his job. McKenty went on.
"Just before he penetrated you, did he force your legs apart?"
Jeannie winced. Surely they should have female cops to ask these questions. Lisa said, "He touched my thigh with the point of the knife."
"Did he cut you?"
"No."
"So you opened your legs voluntarily?"
Jeannie said,
"If a suspect pulls a weapon on a cop, you generally shoot him down, don't you? Do you call that voluntary?"
McKenty gave her an angry look.
"Please leave this to me, miss."
He turned back to Lisa.
"Do you have any injuries at all?"
"I'm bleeding, yes."
"Is that as a result of the forced intercourse?"
"Yes."
"Where are you injured, exactly?"
Jeannie could not stand it any longer.
"Why don't we let the doctor establish that?"
He looked at her as if she were stupid.
"I have to make the preliminary report."
"Then let it say she has internal injuries as a result of the rape."
"I'm conducting this interview, and I'm telling you to back off, mister," Jeannie said,
controlling the urge to scream at him.
"My friend is in distress, and I don't think she needs to describe her internal injuries to you when she's going to be examined by a doctor any second now."
McKenty looked furious, but he moved on.
"I noticed you had on red lace underwear. Do you think that had any effect on what happened?"
Lisa looked away, her eyes full of tears.
Jeannie said, "If I reported my red Mercedes stolen, would you ask me whether I had provoked the theft by driving such an attractive car?"
McKenty ignored her.
"Do you think you might have met the perpetrator before, Lisa?"
"No."
"But the smoke must have made it difficult for you to see clearly,
and he wore a scarf of some kind over his face. At first I was practically blind, but there wasn't much smoke in the room where he did it. I saw him. She nodded to herself. I saw him.
So you would recognize him if you saw him again?
Lisa shuddered. Oh, yes.
But you've never seen him before, like in a bar or anything?
No.
Do you go to bars, Lisa?
Sure.
Singles bar, that kind of thing? Jeannie boiled over. What the hell kind of question is that? The kind defense lawyers ask, Mackenzie said.
Lisa isn't on trial. She's not the perpetrator. She's the victim.
Were you a virgin, Lisa?
Jeannie stood up.
Okay, that's enough. I do not believe this is supposed to happen. You're not supposed to ask these invasive questions.
Mackenzie raised his voice.
I'm trying to establish her credibility.
1 hour after she was violated? Forget it.
I'm doing my job.
I don't believe you know your job.
I don't think you know shit, Mackenzie.
Before he could reply, a doctor walked in without knocking. He was young and looked harassed and tired.
Is this the rape? He said.
This is Ms. Lisa Hoxton, Jeannie said icily.
Yes, she was raped.
I'll need a vaginal swab.
He was charmless, but at least he provided an excuse to get rid of Mackenzie. Jeannie looked at the cop. He stayed put, as if he thought he were going to supervise the taking of the swab.
She said, Before you do that, doctor, perhaps Patrolman Mackenzie will excuse us.
The doctor paused, looking at Mackenzie. The cop shrugged and went out. The doctor pulled the sheet off Lisa with an abrupt gesture.
Lift your gown and spread your legs, he said.
Lisa began to cry. Jeannie could hardly believe it. What was it with these men?
Excuse me, sir, she said to the doctor.
He glared at her impatiently. Have you got a problem? Could you please try to be a little more polite? He reddened. This hospital is full of people with traumatic injuries and life-threatening illnesses, he said.
Right now in the emergency room there are 3 children who have been in a car wreck, and they're all going to die. And you're complaining that I'm not being polite to a girl who got into bed with the wrong man?
Jeannie was flabbergasted.
Got into bed with the wrong man? She repeated.
Lisa sat upright. I want to go home, she said.
That sounds like a hell of a good idea, Jeannie said. She unzipped her duffel and began to put the clothes out on the bed.
The doctor was dumbstruck for a moment. Then he said angrily,
Do as you please.
He went out. Jeannie and Lisa looked at one another. I can't believe that happened, Jeannie said. Thank God they've gone, Lisa said, and she got out of bed. Jeannie helped her take off the hospital gown. Lisa pulled on the fresh clothes quickly and stepped into the shoes. I'll drive you home, Jeannie said. Would you sleep over at my apartment? Lisa said. I don't want to be alone tonight.
Sure,
I'll be glad to. Mackenzie was waiting outside. He seemed less confident. Perhaps he knew he had handled the interview badly.
I still have a few more questions, he said.
Jeannie spoke quietly and calmly. We're leaving, she said. Lisa is too upset to answer questions right now. He was almost scared.
She has to, he said. She's made a complaint.
Lisa said, I wasn't raped. It was all a mistake.